I'm Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. Tonight I have with us Dr. James Dowd, and we're going to talk about his fabulous new book, The Vitamin D Cure, and all of the research that he's done over the years about just what this thing is. How are you, Dr. Dowd?
Good. How are you?
Thanks for coming on. I've been looking forward to this interview. I have a million questions for you. Before we get started, though, why don't you tell us a little bit about you, where to find you, and how you came to do what you do?
Well, I'm a rheumatologist. I'm in Michigan right now, but I grew up in Texas and trained at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston and did my fellowship at Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, and then followed a woman to Michigan, Southeast Michigan, where I've been practicing rheumatology since then. What sparked my interest in vitamin D was after about 3 to 5 years of practicing in Michigan, I began to notice a lot of stiffness and pain in the small joints of my hands, particularly in the late winter and early spring. And then after a few more years, this seemed to be persistent year-round and not just a seasonal thing, and was accompanied by fatigue and muscle aches and cramping, poor sleep, loss of bodily hair, not on my head but on my extremities, and some weight gain. And I thought something must be going on. I don't think this is just what it means to be 40-something. Sort of fortuitously, a patient of mine who had a form of arthritis that was associated with vitamin D deficiency had some of these similar symptoms, and I measured her vitamin D level. She happened to be African-American, and her vitamin D level came back undetectable, and I thought, this is bizarre. How is it possible to have no vitamin D at all? You know, they always tell us casual sun exposure, 10, 15 minutes should be more than enough. Mm-hmm. But clearly this woman wasn't getting enough. And then I started measuring this in other patients, and I started finding it in many patients in my practice, many of who shared a lot of the symptoms I had. So I began taking some vitamin D, and lo and behold, a lot of these symptoms began getting better as well as with my patients. And I thought, man, there's something going on here. I need to explore this a little further. So then sort of obsession took over after that, and I began pouring through the medical literature on vitamin D to try and better understand what vitamin D was, what it was doing to all these different systems, and how it related to me and my patients.
So how long did it, once you started doing it, I mean, I have a whole 3 pages of questions here, but you're covering them so well. How did you know how much to take? How long did you have to take it before you started getting results?
Well, what I
and
found...
And do you have to do something else with it? Sorry, I didn't let that off.
Mm-hmm. No, I found that some of the symptoms of vitamin D deficiency seem to improve almost immediately, and what was very apparent in my patients was the symptom of fatigue seemed to go away almost immediately. And so patients who had very low vitamin D levels, say levels less than 20, 25, when they took vitamin D, usually within days or weeks, and I actually even had some patients state that after the first dose of vitamin D, they felt better. Now, you always have to ask how much of this is placebo effect and how much of this is actually the effect of vitamin D, but I can certainly say there's some consistency about immediate relief of fatigue within days or weeks of beginning supplementation. Things like musculoskeletal pain and sleep and some of these other symptoms that can accompany severe vitamin D deficiency can take more like weeks to months to get significantly better.
All right. If you have like a semi, let's say you have close to a normal range, does it take because you started supplementing, does it take a few days or some time after that normal, or can it take a few days after you get to a normal range before you reap all the benefits, or will all the benefits come at the same time? Does that make
no,
sense?
No, all the benefits will not come at the same time. So if we just touch on vitamin D pharmacology, which is not typical pharmacology like drug pharmacology, because there are so many different active molecules in the vitamin D family, and depending on the state of your body at any given time, whether you're severely deficient or slightly deficient, or whether you have nutritional issues or whatnot, the balance of these different forms of vitamin D will differ. But suffice it to say, it takes about 10 weeks on average to reach a new plateau in vitamin D once you begin some stable supplement regimen. And so your new sort of vitamin D level won't be attained and stable until about 10 weeks of supplementation. And I've seen some symptoms, particularly some of the, you know, like bone pain and sleep disturbance and some of these other things, I've seen patients see improvements months after they've started supplementation. So the response to vitamin D replacement seems to evolve over several months, maybe as long as 6 months in some patients.
Okay. You say that in your book, and I don't want to spend a lot of time here because I have a million questions, but I want people to understand. You say vitamin D is not a vitamin but a hormone. Why do you say that?
Well, vitamin D is in is a sterol hormone in the same family of steroid hormones as estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and cortisol. And so, when all of these, what these sterol hormones share in common is their parent molecule, which is cholesterol. So all of these begin as cholesterol, and then they're modified, and sort of at the end of the line of modification is vitamin D. And so it starts out as cholesterol, is modified to 7-dehydrocholesterol in the liver, and then travels in our bloodstream bound to either fats or D-binding protein or other proteins, gets to the skin where it's exposed to ultraviolet B spectrum radiation, and is undergoes a stereochemical reaction where it's twisted to a different conformation, and then is transported back to the liver where it gets modified to 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which is what we measure when we get a blood test, and so that is the substrate for the active hormone, and the active hormone is one modification further, which is 1-25-dihydroxyvitamin D, and what we've learned in the last, you know, decade or so is that really pretty much every cell in our body has the ability to convert that pro-hormone into the active hormone that we know as vitamin D, that conversion occurs relative to demand. So if you have an infection in your lungs, so you have pneumonia, the resident immune system cells we call macrophages in the lung, when they're turned on by infectious agents, will start producing 1-alpha-hydroxylase, which is the enzyme that converts the pro-hormone to the active hormone. And then the active hormone helps to fight the infection. And that's probably true of cancer and other mechanisms of action that vitamin D has, is it's sort of an on-demand production. You have this background level of active vitamin D, but whenever you need it for infection or fighting cancer or some other specific issue, those cells at that site can begin producing active hormone.
Does the blood test give you accurate results, or should you use something like a spectrocell and do intracellular lab tests, or does it matter?
Well, there has been quite a bit of controversy over different means of testing 25-hydroxyvitamin D, and that's the test you should get. There are two different tests you can request from a practitioner. One is a 25-hydroxyvitamin D, and the other is a 1-25-dihydroxyvitamin D. And the 25 gives us a measure of this supply line of pro-hormone, which is what we want to want to know the information on. The 125 level usually does not vary from disease state to disease state, so it's of little value to measure 125-dihydroxy-D. So there are two basic methods of measuring 25-hydroxy-D. One is a mass spec, which is a high-performance liquid chromatography that is then put through a mass spectrometry to verify those results. And so you're taking a peak off of a chromatography, and then you're honing it down and then verifying that that peak is what you're looking for. The other is an immunoassay, what we found is that both can be very accurate, but the mass spec test with the liquid chromatography with mass spec requires a lot of controls. There's a lot of room for human error in the test because there are so many steps. And that if a laboratory is not paying attention to details, you can get spurious results with mass spec, whereas the ELISA or the immunoassay to measure it using a monoclonal antibody that was discovered that measures both D2 and D3 eliminates a lot of human error, so it's almost completely automated when you use the immunoassay. And we found the controversy was with Quest Labs and some other smaller labs that use mass spec, that because of the volume, recently increased volume of testing, they haven't been able to control the execution of the test well, and so they get some spurious results. And a number of physicians, including myself, have found levels that can be 50% higher than what the patient actually has with these mass specs that aren't done properly. So I usually try and tell patients to do it using the immunoassay, specifically the Diasorin immunoassay, which is the company that makes the test that's been used in it's been used by Harvard, all the Harvard cohorts. It's been used by the USDA and NHANES databases, and so large databases in the U.S. government have decided that that particular test provides the most reliable results.
So are the tests normally high or low? I understand you saying they're normally high.
Typically, they err on the high side.
Okay. Okay. So they say that it's like 60 or 46, maybe, and it's really 20. Is that what you're saying, or something?
Correct.
Like that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. If you don't take enough omega fats with it or your minerals, will you get the same result?
Well, so it was interesting to me. What got me to look at that question further was you can't help but study rickets as a prototypical disease in vitamin D deficiency. It was the sort of the originally described disease we associate with vitamin D deficiency some 100-plus years ago. And what was interesting is that in recent reports of rickets, and there has been a rise in the number of case reports in the medical literature on rickets, was that the vitamin D levels in these children that presented with and were documented to have rickets varied quite widely. So some of these children had vitamin D levels that were abysmally low, kind of like the patient I saw, undetectable levels of vitamin D, and others had vitamin D levels in the 30 range, 40, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, and you're thinking, okay, if this disease is purely vitamin D deficiency, then there should be some sort of threshold below which you get these disease symptoms and above which you don't have them. And it didn't appear that that was the case. So the questions that were brought up were, well, what role does calcium play in presentation of rickets, and is it calcium and vitamin D deficiency that's precipitating the disease state? What role does malnutrition, generally speaking, so protein malnutrition and other things, because we notice when we look at populations in India, many Indians are vegans, and they are relatively protein malnourished. And so they present with things like rickets and osteomalacia seemingly more commonly than even, say, African Americans, who also have very dark skin and very low vitamin D levels. And so protein malnutrition, lack of calcium in the diet, And maybe even magnesium deficiency. There are some old reports of rickets cases where the patients did not respond, the children did not respond to vitamin D replacement until their magnesium was replaced, and so they were relatively resistant to vitamin D replacement. So there are clearly other nutrients that play a role in manifesting certainly the musculoskeletal and bone manifestations of severe vitamin D deficiency, and I would gather that they probably also influence the expression of other symptoms of vitamin D deficiency. So it then opened up to this whole, because half the book's about diet and making sure you get enough protein and these other things, and that's where that came from is these questions that arose in looking at rickets more closely.
Interesting. What about the omega oils? Should it be 3 or 6 or both? And will you get the same results if you don't take enough oils?
Well, omega-3 fatty acid, there was a study that was published suggesting that omega-3s may bind to the same receptor complex that vitamin D and vitamin A bind to. And so there may be some spillover effect that omega-3 fatty acids actually help to activate the vitamin D receptor. And vitamin D typically pairs itself with vitamin A, so it's the vitamin D, the VDR or vitamin D receptor complexed with the retinoic X receptor or one of the vitamin A receptors, and then a whole host of cofactors. And omega-3s seem to bind to that same complex. So it raised the question, you know, what role does omega-3 fatty acids play in activation of the vitamin D receptor and its signaling? And it is specific to omega-3s, and it may be specific to DHA rather than EPA, and not alpha-linolenic acid, which is flaxseed oil, for example. So it is the mammalian omega-3 fatty acids and DHA in particular that may be binding to the vitamin D receptor and also participating in activating the receptor. So those omega-3s typically come from fish or fish oil products or fish liver oil products. Now, fish liver oil is very high in vitamin A, and you have to be careful with using fish liver oils as a supplement because you can get way too much vitamin A in trying to get enough omega-3 and vitamin D. But purified, molecularly distilled fish oil products can concentrate EPA and DHA, and those are what I recommend in the book that patients supplement. And if you just look at it, not even outside of the whole vitamin D issue, if you just look at cultures like Icelanders, Nordic peoples, Japanese, their average sort of intake of omega-3 in their usual diet, because they're such a high intake of seafood, is in the order of 1,200 milligrams a day, as compared to the American diet, which the average American consumes less than 200 milligrams of omega-3. And omega-3 has been associated with intelligence in children. When you look at omega-3 intake in the pregnant mother and the IQ scores of the children from that pregnancy at 4 years of age, there are some weaker associations between onset and progression of dementia and omega-3 fatty acids. So these higher intakes of omega-3 clearly have some health consequences that reach from cardiovascular to central nervous system. And how much of that is the vitamin D receptor playing a role in those disease states through omega-3s, I don't think we have the information on that, but it is intriguing.
You also talk about I don't want to leave this. Hold on a minute. I want to go back up a little bit. You talk about insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and metabolic changes, inflammatory diseases, diabetes, arthritis. Talk just a little bit about that before we move on.
Okay.
The contribution of those diseases to not enough having enough vitamin D.
So
I was shocked.
The study that sort of brought that to light was an NHANES database study where NHANES' National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which is sort of the census of our diet that the government does every decade or so, asking a swath of the U.S. population, what are you eating on a day-to-day basis? And then they sort of calculate our nutrient intakes, and unfortunately they tell us we eat a lousy diet but then don't do anything about it, and hope that we will make changes, which typically doesn't happen. But that NHANES data from, I want to say it was 2000, was the last data point collection, basically showed fairly strong associations between low vitamin D levels, and I think they used a cutoff of below 30 versus above 37, so it was like bottom quintile, upper quintile of vitamin D, and those were the numbers I think they used as cutoffs. And they found that there was significant associations with the low vitamin D levels and obesity, hypertension, the likelihood of having diabetes, hypertriglyceridemia, and so several key features of the metabolic syndrome were now linked to vitamin D deficiency. Now, this wasn't a cause-effect study. This is just a population-based relationship. And then that was taken further when Tommy Wang and an Austrian group looked at large cohorts in the association of cardiovascular events and all-cause mortality and vitamin D deficiency, and found significant relationships that seem to be dose-dependent, meaning the lower your vitamin D level, the higher your risk, the higher your vitamin D level, the lower your risk. And so all of these things began to seriously focus our attention on this molecule as something that's tied to diseases that are very prevalent in the U.S. population. And I think that's when the excitement about vitamin D about a year and a half or two ago kind of exploded.
Should we give this to our children?
Well, that's the
our
kind
little
of the,
kids.
Yeah, that's
teenagers?
The case. That's the case I make in the book, because what we know about vitamin D is that as a steroid hormones, the unique one of the interesting and unique things about steroid hormones is that they turn genes on and they turn genes off. So they regulate gene expression, and they either ramp it up or they shut it down. And when is that more important than during fetal development? And we know from, and I briefly mentioned this in the book, David Barker, who's a scientist at Southampton in UK, observed in a cohort that was looking at people who were pregnant during the famines in Denmark during World War II, during Nazi occupation. And he said, okay, I wonder what happened to these kids from these pregnancies during famine now 50-some-odd years later. What's their health relative to their peers who were gestated before or after that famine? And what he found was about a threefold increased risk for the metabolic syndrome, and that study, and then he reproduced that in an Indian population, in the U.S. population. So he reproduced it in several countries across the globe using epidemiologic data. Then he took that back to the lab, and he took rodents, and he starved them during pregnancy or didn't, and then evaluated the offspring and found that they had higher blood pressures, they had higher body mass, they had smaller kidneys, they had their microanatomy and their macroanatomy and their physiology was all different because of starvation, either protein malnutrition or total calorie malnutrition during gestation. So so nutrition during gestation, during fetal development, is absolutely critical. And if you're thinking about molecules that actually regulate gene expression, that's when it's all being expressed or not expressed. That's when you determine what piano keys are being played in your genome is during fetal development. And so I think that we're only at the tip of the iceberg of understanding, at least for this specific molecule, what its influence had. Just for example, women who had, the Lancet study showed that women who had, they stratified pregnant women according to their vitamin D level. And then they measured bone density in their offspring from that pregnancy 9 years later. And they found a direct correlation to their vitamin D level 9 years later. So you're seeing children late in childhood that were influenced by what was going on during gestation with that particular molecule and their bones. So then the question is, what is it doing for their brain? And there's some question as to whether it has something to do with autism and some of these other disorders of behavior in children, and that vitamin D may be one of those key nutrients during pregnancy that influences the expression of that disease later in childhood. Schizophrenia, a type 1 diabetes. So there's a number of different diseases where there's this the link goes all the way back to either at birth or probably before birth with not enough or exposure to vitamin D.
So do we give it to our? I have a 9-year-old and a 15-year-old. Do I supplement them?
Here's how I practice in my office. And this was just around the time I was getting excited about vitamin D. This is middle of 04. I just decided, you know, I've found this in just about everybody I measured, so the rule of thumb in my office is anybody who walks through the door gets a vitamin D level. And I believe there's enough data now that it is something that should be part of routine health screening to know what it is. And not necessarily that just correcting that is going to be the cure-all for everything, but I think it's an important piece of a bigger puzzle. And addressing broader lifestyle issues, which I tried to do in the book, I think is the better way to approach it, not just D, but diet and additional targeted nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
And so for kids, I think this is particularly important that if they're going in for an evaluation, say they're going in for a booster vaccine or something, get them to have their vitamin D level measured. Now, if you're not so inclined to see a physician and get the blood level measured, there's a little risk quiz in the book, and you can do it online, www.thevitamindcure.com, and there's a risk analysis sort of quiz where you can answer the questions and decide what your risk for deficiency is. And if you're high risk or very high risk, you probably should begin supplementation. And I think it's reasonable to measure it at some later point to see if your supplementation is on target, because you can be very precise about calculating your dose using the tables in the book. I generally recommend that most people, because the data supports that. I mean, the data from the USDA or the CDC. I'm sorry, the CDC data shows that about 55% of adult males are deficient. Probably 65% of Caucasian women are deficient. Some 75% of Latinos and 90 to 100% of African Americans, and those numbers are probably no different in children of the same racial categories. So, when we look at African American children, and there are small cohorts of that, their deficiencies are up in the 90 percentile. When we look at Caucasian cohorts of children, their deficiencies are in the 50 to 65 percentile range. So I don't think there's a significant difference between ages and the likelihood of being deficient.
Okay, I have a couple questions. I'm going to put it all together for you. I want to know, how would you know if you had vitamin D toxicity? I want to know, do you have to take calcium supplements if you're supplementing D? Then I want you to talk some about, every time I've shown somebody your book, they go, oh, well, I've been doing sunbathing. But they haven't read the book, so they don't, you know, they use sunscreen, or they go out, you know, Saturday afternoon and the late afternoon for a while after it's too hot. So talk about those things, please.
Okay, so toxicity. This is always, you know, everybody has learned in the last 2 to 3 decades that fat-soluble vitamins are dangerous because they accumulate in your system and you can get toxic very easily. So be careful with fat-soluble vitamins, and vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin. but most of that warning is relative to probably vitamin A. If we were to look at the fat-soluble vitamins, which fat-soluble vitamin has there been the most reports of toxicity? Hands down, it's vitamin A. Okay, and that's because vitamin A is fortified in a lot of food products, in a lot of oils that show up in food products, and vitamins typically include tremendous amounts of vitamin A in them. And so there's so many different sources we're getting it from that toxicity is much more likely with A than with any of the other fat-soluble vitamins. And there does seem to be a fairly low threshold for toxicity. There was a study done in reported in the New England Journal of Medicine that was looking at beta-carotene or retinol as a preventative agent for lung cancer in a smoking population. And what they found 3 years, it was supposed to be something like a 10-year study, but 3 years into the study, they stopped collecting data because the patients who were getting the vitamin A, beta-carotene, I think it was a combination of beta-carotene retinol supplementation, had significantly more lung cancer than those who were not getting supplemented. So, and from that study, the DRI, so the daily recommended intake, which used to be the RDA, was reduced from 5,000 units to 3,000 units. So vitamin A, there are some issues with, and you have to be careful. Even when you're supplementing vitamin D, you have to be careful that it's not a product that also contains vitamin A, and in an effort to replace D, you're getting too much A. So the vitamin D toxicity issue has been looked at very closely by Reinhold Veith, who's a professor of medicine at University of Toronto. And he's done a series of studies. The most recent one that makes us feel comfortable with supplementation, even in the absence of a blood test, is a study he was doing on a group of MS patients, multiple sclerosis patients. And he titrated these patients up to 40,000. Basically, every 3 months, he doubled their dose till they got up to 40,000 units of D3, not D2. And we can have that discussion too, of D3 daily, over a 3 to 6 month period of time, saw no high blood calcium levels, saw no high calcium levels in the urine, saw no kidney stones, saw nothing. Now, it's a fairly small group of patients that he's published thus far. He has a slightly larger group of the same in the same study that is pending publication, but it's pretty good in evidence suggesting that these very high doses are quite safe. Now, in the book I don't advocate people taking these tens of thousands of units a day. I think that if you replace according to your body weight using the tables in the book, or use fudge factors like 20 units per pound, you get these vitamin D intakes of somewhere between 2 and 6,000 units per day, depending on your weight, maybe a little more, maybe a little less, but it's in that sort of ballpark. And at those ranges, there's never been any reported toxicity on vitamin D. And a blood level probably has to exceed 250 nanograms per mil before you see any toxicity, and an oral dose of D3 probably has to exceed that 40,000 units before you're likely to see any toxicity. Now, this is, again, I try and focus on, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin and it seems to correlate with weight, that you're obviously not going to give, you know, these monstrous doses to a two-year-old who weighs, you know, 30 pounds. You probably could see toxicity in a child if you were to give them 40,000 units a day. These studies are all done in adults. And with the average size of adults increasing every year, these are probably pretty good-sized adults that are getting this 40,000 units a day. So toxicity is extremely rare. It requires very high doses, probably in excess of 40,000 units a day for an adult for a sustained period of time, meaning probably more than 3 months. and causing blood levels to rise above 250 nanograms per mil. So it's unusual, and but here's an example of. So I'm not concerned about toxicity except in a situation where some people buy products over the counter that are either mislabeled or just poorly manufactured. And I do have a history of a case of some children who were measured by their pediatrician, were found to be very low. Their levels were 10, 15. He did not know what to recommend, so he said, just get something off the Internet and give it to him. So that's what Mom did. She got on the Internet, found some liquid vitamin D drops, started giving them a drop a day, then he measured their blood level again, and their blood levels were around 200. And he said, whoa, okay, I think you need to go see Dr. Dowd because something's not right here. And she brought the bottle in, and I looked at it and said, man, I don't even know where this came from. And so clearly it was a product that was poorly manufactured, and the concentration was not quality controlled, and these kids were getting too much. And I just took them off D for a couple months. Their levels came down, and then I recalculated their dose using a reliable product, and they were fine after that. And they never did experience any toxicity symptoms, but I don't think they were on it long enough for anything like that to happen.
What would you see if they did? If they were toxic, what would I have seen?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. I mean, typically in the things we see in studies that are reported in the literature are peripheral calcification, so you can get calcification in muscle and in brain and in organs. You can get kidney stones because above a certain level of vitamin D, and we don't know exactly what that threshold is because it hasn't been identified clearly, but at very high vitamin D levels, you start to hyperabsorb calcium from your diet, and then you become hypercalcemic, and you start excreting excess calcium in your urine, which then can precipitate kidney stones, and the high calcium levels in your blood can cause dehydration, because as you excrete that calcium in your urine, it pulls water with it, and so the typical symptoms are polyuria, which is going to the bathroom a lot, peeing a lot, if you will, and polydipsia, which is thirsty all the time to try and make up for what you're peeing out all the time. So if someone's getting excessively thirsty, getting up throughout the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and they've been taking whopping doses of vitamin D, they need to suspect toxicity and probably stop supplementing and go get their blood level measured if they haven't had that done already.
So what about sunbathing?
So sunbathing, we all need a whole lot more sun than we think we do, just like we need a whole lot more exercise than we think we do. And we need a whole lot more skin exposed. So let's start with the typical recommendations you hear from the medical community. 10 or 15 minutes is enough. Well, what do they mean by that? Well, 15 minutes of sun exposure is enough if the other following things hold true. One, you have at least 50% of your skin exposed. That's shorts and a t-shirt. Number two, you're getting that exposure in the middle of the day near solar noon, okay? Because ultraviolet B radiation is typically only available, and it changes. This window of opportunity grows as you get towards summer solstice, and then it begins to shrink as it is now. It's beginning to shrink as you move away from the summer solstice. And so that window of opportunity disappears in the northern half of the country, say above 35, 37 degrees latitude, sometime in the fall, October or something, it's pretty much gone. And from October through March, half the northern half of the United States is not making any vitamin D. I don't care how sunny it is. Between those months, it's not happening. So you want to be in the middle of the day where you know that window lies, and you can't wear sunscreen if you want to make vitamin D because SPF 8, and nobody uses SPF 8, they use SPF 15 or 40 or some odd, and SPF 8, Michael Hollick has shown blocks 97.5% of UVB radiation and vitamin D production. And SPF 15 is like 99% blocking of vitamin D production. So it has to be middle of the day, The right season of the year, because you can't do it in winter, 50% or more skin exposure, no sunscreen. Now, when you put all of those requirements on that 15 minutes, probably 90% of the country can never get that sun exposure, particularly if you need to get it three or more times a week to make an adequate amount of vitamin D to sustain you through the week. So most of us don't get that kind of sun exposure. We might get it with our just hands and face exposed at lunchtime when we go on a break outside, but we're not getting this enough skin exposure and enough time to make an adequate amount of vitamin D. So most of us need to probably take some supplement to get our levels in the normal range.
I have a question here. Somebody told me the other day that even if you do sunbathe, that you can't take a bath or wash or get in the water because it does something. Is that true?
I'm not.
For a certain amount of
time. All of this is occurring in the skin itself, so it's now in animals that may be different. Animals that are fur-covered animals that have coats, but in humans, as far as we know, it's not the sweat that's the issue. It's actually occurring in the outer layers of the dermis and the deeper layers of the epidermis. So that's where the stereochemical reaction is occurring. It's in that subcutaneous fat. And as we get older, this is interesting, as we get older, the amount of 7-dehydrocholesterol production drops and the amount of subcutaneous fat we have drops. And so this production facility, if you will, becomes less efficient as we age because we don't have that subcutaneous fat like children do and younger adults do. And so our ability to make vitamin D from sun exposure becomes less efficient as we age. So that if you're just comparing someone at age 20 to, say, age 80, they may require two or more times the amount of sun exposure at 80 than they did at 20 to make the same amount of vitamin D.
Interesting. What about acidity and alkalinity? Does that matter?
Well,
we've got, let me just tell you, we've got about 12 minutes, okay?
12 minutes. So you did mention of these three questions, and I'll touch on that and use that as a segue. Calcium is an alkaline mineral. And vitamin D is required for calcium absorption. And so if your vitamin D level is zero, you're absorbing zero calcium. And if your vitamin D level crests about 35, you sort of maximize your calcium absorption at about 35 to 40%. And so do you need to supplement calcium? Well, it really depends on what else you're eating in your diet. I mean, no wild animals consume dairy products and take all these calcium supplements, and they don't have any bone or dental problems like the humans do. And it's because they're getting so many other alkaline minerals in their diet from vegetable matter. And this is what I stumbled across when I started looking at calcium metabolism. So you probably don't need to. The short answer is you don't need to take 12 to 1,500 milligrams of calcium a day if you're taking enough vitamin D to normalize your blood level. You probably don't need any more than about half that or 500 milligrams of calcium a day. And many of us should be able to get that in our diet alone, assuming we're eating those foods that are high in alkaline minerals like calcium. And those foods are principally green leafy vegetables, so kale, collard greens, Swiss chard, bok choy. These are loaded with potassium, magnesium, and calcium. And all of these alkaline minerals share some of the same work of alkalinizing our system relative to the amount of protein intake we have. So protein produces organic acids as a waste product like uric acid from protein digestion, and vegetable matter digestion produces citrates and bicarb that tend to come with these divalent and monovalent cations of potassium, magnesium, and calcium. And so as a way of measuring and helping us figure out how much of protein do we need versus how much produce we need, this acid-base equation simplifies the calculation of those amounts, and that's what I used it for in the book, was to help you understand how much you needed to eat in, as far as vegetable matter to neutralize any acid produced by protein intake.
That's one of the best books I've ever read, I have to tell you, by the way. I have so many symptoms that's in that book, but I had no idea what it could possibly be until I read your book. I was shocked. So thank you for doing what you do.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you. It's my passion. So I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to talk about anything you want to talk about that we've not already talked about.
Well, so I'll just talk about how my thinking is evolving. You know, I think that science has been misdirected, and the momentum of that misdirection has led us astray, if you will. And what I mean by that is, you know, when I was in training, it was all about genetics, and our genes determine everything, and whatever your genes say is what's going to happen to you. And now we have this epigenetic phenomenon that has really thrown away everything we've said about genetics. And epigenetics is this idea that the environment actually influences what genes are expressed, kind of like vitamin D, but also from other nutrients like folic acid and other things that influence methylation of DNA, which is how DNA is packaged. And the idea is that if DNA is packaged the wrong way, then you can't even access certain genes to turn them on. And so what we're learning now is that actually our environment plays critical roles in what genes are turned on and what genes are turned off. And all of that has to do with our behavior, what we're eating, whether we're exercising or not. Even emotions may influence these epigenetic phenomenon and influence how genes are expressed, particularly in infants and during gestation. I mean, we all are aware of those monkey studies where if the monkey doesn't get cuddled, the baby monkey doesn't get cuddled, their mental state is kind of screwed up for the rest of their life. And that probably has something to do with epigenetics. And so there's this tremendous influence now, or emphasis now, on that the genetic sequence is actually not that important. That it's the environment that it's found in that alters how it's expressed, which puts a lot more emphasis on environment, and that's something to a much greater extent we have some control over.
Can you define environment, please?
Environment meaning not just the weather, but all the foods we eat, and maybe even how we eat our foods. Here's something I've observed, and I always fall back on Mother Nature as the thing to observe to figure out whether we're doing the right thing or not. So it came to me the other day. I said, you know what? I think that the hunt is the meal preparation. In other words, when a wolf is stalking and chasing an animal and is releasing, you know, cortisol and adrenaline, that those hormones and the other hormones that are released during the hunt actually sensitize the tissues to insulin and prepare the body for that meal. And humans have separated the exercise from the meal. In nature, you have to exercise to eat, that they're inseparable activities. And if you stop moving, you're dead. You're either someone else's meal or you starve. And so we've separated that activity from the meal, and so we're not even preparing our bodies for the nutrition that's to come. And so when you exercise vigorously and then eat a meal that's heavy in protein and fat and vegetable matter, you've actually prepared your body through the exercise. And there's some recent studies that came out from Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, showing that the physiology and the hormones are very different when you have preprandial or before meal exercise versus no exercise before a meal. That the meal is completely processed differently. And we've lost that in our behavior, in our lifestyles now, and we need to get that back. And so it really changes how you think about how you organize your day, when you work out, and what meals you have after your workout. And if you haven't been exercising and been sedentary, what meal should you have in the face of that last 4 hours of no activity? Maybe it should just be, you know, a salad and no meat, nothing that will release insulin, sort of like a grazing animal. That's low energy activity is followed by low energy food, and high energy activity is followed by a higher energy food. And it completely changes how you think about how your day should be organized, or how you should organize what meals when. So sequence of meals and sequence of foods actually becomes important. It's not just, well, I'm just going to put all of this good stuff into a shake in the morning and call it done. well, that doesn't work because no other
answer
to it.
Very interesting.
That way.
Never thought about that. I want to ask you another question, if you don't mind. I'm
sure.
Cutting off some of your time. A lot of us are magnesium wasting. Do you know? And I've started using transdermal magnesium, but do you know why we're magnesium wasting?
Well, some of it has to do with not getting enough, because the average American it takes in less than one serving of vegetable matter a day, and that's where most of our magnesium comes from, is green leafy vegetables. So some of it's just deficiency because of lack of intake. The other is probably this acid-base equation. If we're consuming mostly foods like cheese and grain and meat that are very high in production, acid production, then that acid, your body's going to say, well, we've got to neutralize it somehow. So your physiology, your metabolism pulls these alkaline minerals out of bone and muscle to neutralize it and then dumps it in your urine.
Okay.
And so we're consuming all of the alkaline stores we have to neutralize this very acidic diet we have. And then we're not replacing it because we don't have it in the foods in our diet that are there to replace that.
Okay. That gives me something else to think about. Because I've interviewed a couple of women who write about magnesium, and one of them in particular, magnesium waste. She says, no matter how much I put in, I can't keep it. But that makes a lot of sense. Okay, I'm sorry. Anything else you want to talk about?
No,
about 3 minutes.
That's 3 minutes, huh?
You can tell us where to find you again and where to find this fabulous book.
The website for the book is www.thevitamindcure.com. I have a blog, and the blog usually goes over the latest literature and provides a recipe from Kelly Chez, who's a gourmet cook who I work with here in Michigan. Once a month we put out a blog with a recipe and literature, going through the literature. There's a sun calculator on the website, the UV calculator, so you can actually calculate how many minutes at a given zip code. So it'll use the real-time UV index from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration when you plug in the zip code, and it'll tell you how many minutes right now you need to get to make enough vitamin D, after which you can either decide to cover up with clothing or put sunscreen on. So it's a safe sun calculator. The risk calculator's on there as well. All of the references in the book are linked to the National Library of Medicine, so you can actually read the abstracts, and those are in the resources section on the website. And I chose references so that roughly 75% of the references have full text available. So if you're so inclined, you can read all of the same 400 or 500 references I read in writing the book, and you can read the papers yourself and interpret it as you like. And so it's a very resourceful website. I think there's lots of information there on the website.
And your book, again, is Vitamin D Cure. And it has lots of charts and graphs and numbers to help you compute exactly how much you need. That was great. Thank you.
And it came out in a paperback in May.
It's a wonderful book. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks
All
for
right.
having me.
You got to come back again sometime. I could ask you.
Oh, I'd love to.
Two pages. Thank you, Dr. Dowd, and I'll have you back if you'll come.
I will come. Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Hare.